History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold if we're willing to invest a little time and attention to ask some questions and then be patient enough to listen as long-buried memories start to rise to the surface. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we go down that road, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is a Pearl Harbor survivor who also survived the sinking of his ship later in the war, floating on a raft for 2 days before being picked up by the most famous PT boat ever, PT-109, before John F. Kennedy took over as its commander. 100-year-old Geb Galley lives in Moses Lake, Washington, but his early years were spent far, far away. Let's start out with what you remember, Geb, about your childhood in Germany.
Of course, we had a small farm over there, and of course, we raised a little different types of grains, hops, and we had cherry trees and various apple trees and stuff on, I think, a 15-acre farm. Because I remember picking cherries off the cherry tree over there. My dad was going to work up there, and he would set me up in the cherry tree, and I could sit there and eat cherries, which was a thrill.
And I know you were only seven when you moved to America, but was German your first language?
Oh, yeah. I went to school over there for a year. Uh-huh. We spoke German at home, so we spoke very fluently. Now, we didn't speak the real high German. In various parts of the country, they had different slangs, you know. But general rule was most of it spoken was high German. Then, of course, the local slang.
How much of that have you retained at age 100?
Well, if my brother or his sister was here, we could then dig up quite a bit of it, remind each other of what we used for certain things. For instance, when I mentioned, say, a horse, we call it a horse. We call a cow a coo. Then we had a different name for different things. We shortcut a lot of things.
You were very young, but did you have some chores on that farm you had to do in Germany?
I was a kid. I mean, we'd done a little of everything, much or nothing.
What was it like for a seven-year-old to come halfway across the world and leave Germany for America? Do you remember that?
My mother had a distant cousin over in Milwaukee. You got to remember things that World War One were tough over there. Her cousin or whatever he was explained what was available to do over here. If they could sell their farm and come over here, they could establish themselves quite well. That was back in the late 20s. So they had a chance to sell their farm there, made the arrangement to come to America, and took the chance.
Well, and that makes me wonder. You mentioned World War One. Had your father been involved in World War One?
Oh, yeah, he was in World War One. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I think he was a medic.
So your father fought for Germany in World War One, and if you guys hadn't moved, Hitler would have been trying to conscript you into the army in World War II.
My father wouldn't be here now if I had stayed over there. I'm very happy that we came to this country. And I was very happy to be able to serve in this country. I served 6 years in the Navy.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. You are in some pretty hairy situations. But I'm curious, because today if we want to go from Germany to America, we hop on a plane and it's no big deal. How did you get here in 1928?
We came to St. Thomas, North Dakota. There was a representative that came to Germany, and he got people to come over and establish in North Dakota, and they had to be staged us in St. Thomas, North Dakota, a small village.
That must have been a long journey across the Atlantic for you, though.
Oh, yeah. Of course, us kids, you know, I mean, we enjoyed being on a ship.
I see that. You're standing right on the life ring of the ship when you came over.
Yeah.
Was that a pretty adventurous journey?
Well, put yourself in the boat when you were 6, 7 years old. How much would you remember?
When I was 100, I probably wouldn't remember anything, but I'm not as sharp as you.
I can remember being on the ship and some of those kids were trouble we get into. Stay off the line, you know, and stay off of this here and stay off of that there. And of course, being my father, very strict. When he said jump, we said how high. Is that the way your father was?
Probably not as strict, but yeah, we had some discipline.
And then, of course, we went to school in St. Thomas, North Dakota, in the first grade. We sat there. We couldn't understand English. And as kids, we could probably start comprehending the language a lot faster than adults could. My brother and I, we stopped over at a butcher shop. Now, the butcher there, he could speak German. Mm-hmm. So we went over there, and then, of course, we asked him, I said, now, what do you call that? He said, you call that a pig. Okay, that's a pig. Down one. And then we'd ask him different things. As kids, I think, could kick the language up much faster than adults could. And the teacher we happened to have in the first grade, see you speak German too. Not fluently, but enough to get by. As kids, then we gradually picked up the language as it went along. And then, of course, as we played with other kids, we picked up fairly quickly. We got along quite well.
So did you have a farm in North Dakota, too?
Oh, yeah. They came over here, lived in St. Thomas, North Dakota, for a couple of years. Then they finally bought a farm north of St. Thomas, North Dakota, about 10 miles. The thing was, my dad, of course, he worked for farmers near St. Thomas, learned the tradition of how they'd done things in the United States or in that part of the country. It was quite a learning process for the whole family.
These are the years of the Great Depression. What do you remember about that? Were there some things your family had to do to get by during those tough economic times?
My dad went and helped different big farmers, and that way he had some income. It was pretty meager. But in those days, I mean, a nickel or a dime went a long ways.
And do you remember, as a boy, did you have a dream, an ambition, a thought of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do?
Oh, multimillionaire, like we all do. No, the thing is, well, we all had our pipe dreams, you know, at that time. Oh, if I could only have a Model T, boy, I'd be King Farouk. You know, we all had our pipe dreams. We still do. The human race lives on pipe dreams, really, when you get right down to it. And then out of those pipe dreams, you pick up what you want and try to see if you make something out of them.
What about high school? Were you playing sports in school or anything?
Then high school was high school.
You didn't go to high school?
At that time, you couldn't afford to go to high school.
They needed you on the farm?
Well, we lived 10 miles from the town where they had high school. So in the meantime, we went to a country school where they taught eighth grades, first through the eighth grade. You learned that, and then if you were going to afford it, they'd send the kids to high school, but they had to drive into town every day. And then wintertime in North Dakota, it's pretty hard to get in town at times. So then, of course, they had a board out in town. If you could afford to board the kids out, then you could send them to high school. Things were tough then.
So after eighth grade, you were done with school?
That was done, yeah. Mm-hmm. I worked out on the farm, worked from home, stuff like that. And then when I got to be 18, a friend of mine, he went and joined the Navy, and he came home from leave. I talked to him about what the Navy was like. I think I'll join the Navy too. So I went in and joined the Navy. Most of the time, yeah, I signed up 4 years, but during 38, 39, 40, 41, yeah, I signed up for 6 years. I said, what the heck? What's 4 years, a handful, six, piece of cake. And I went through training to the Great Lakes Naval Training Station. Then, of course, we were shipped out to San Pedro, and we put on various ships, and I had to be assigned to the Nevada. And then after we were all assigned to different ships, then we took off and went to Hawaii. And we sat there in Hawaii. Went out once every couple, two, 3 months for gunnery practice, a few things we had to do until the war broke out.
So you're in the Navy. Was that a tough adjustment, getting used to the Navy life?
I was 18. You were there looking for excitement. Going to the Navy, that was exciting.
And what was your duty on the ship?
Well, to start work, scrub deck, about almost a year. I transferred to the engineering division, and I worked in the refrigeration and air conditioning department, and also in the engine room for a short period of time, depending on the ranks. And so I made my ranks as a graduate as I went up, but the most time I stayed in the refrigeration and air conditioning. I took care of all the refrigeration and air conditioning aboard ship.
And what was it like to be around all those other guys on the ship? Because they're probably from all over the country, right?
Oh, yeah. And, of course, being I was a foreigner, and the only way I was able to become a citizen, my mother had to become a citizen. When she did, then I could become a citizen. And then, of course, I went in the Navy, then, of course, I then was an American citizen.
What was it like to be stationed at Pearl Harbor before the Japanese attacked? What was that life like? A lot of guys have told me it was like paradise, and they were living a dream over there.
Most of the time, we were aboard ship, and of course, that we could go ashore, go out to the Waikiki Beach, and go swimming and stuff like that. There wasn't all that much you could do over in Hawaii at that time, except go out to the beach and enjoy it, which we did.
Did you try surfing at all?
Yes.
Didn't go so well?
Didn't do well at all. No. Oh, I tried it, but it wasn't my cup of tea.
I won't call you Duke Kawanamoku. I'll stick to Geb. How well did you get to know your shipmates before the war?
Well, the ones that worked in your different department, you got to know them quite close. I mean, you had to work with each other, so you could tolerate each other.
And did you personally have any idea or thought or anticipation that war was coming? That war was imminent?
No, we had no idea. I mean, we just done our little thing aboard ship, but daily duties and stuff like that. And every couple of months, we go out for a practice run, probably target practice and stuff like that, with your 5-inch and 14-inch guns. And go out for probably a week or so, and then back in again. And we lay in tied to in the harbor, and the only thing you could really do was go ashore and get drunk or go out on the beaches and go swimming and stuff like that.
So what did you do on Saturday night, December 6th?
December 6th was aboard ship, nothing. Same as usual. Mm-hmm. Got my meals, and that was it.
And how about Sunday morning? Let's talk about December 7th. I'm sure that was a long day for you, but how did it start?
Well, Sunday morning, as a matter of fact, I had my whites on, and I was ready to go ashore, and I was going to go to church. And my compartment was the first deck below, the first deck there. I happened to look out the porthole, and I noticed there was some planes were flying around, but I didn't pay attention to the insignia on them. They were Japanese planes. And then all of a sudden, I seen, of course, the band was up on the fantail playing for the colors to be raised. And they came running down with the drums and instruments and stuff like that. Say, holler, everybody, man your battle stations. Typical GI. All the time on Sunday morning, they have to hold it, practice, stuff like that. So I just went up and I had to go down two decks to the ice machine room. And all you do is stay down there and see what was going to happen.
Little did he know that what was going to happen would change the world and would still be reverberating 80 years later. It's time for our first break. But when we come back, what the rest of December 7th, 1941 was like for Geb and what happened to the next ship he was assigned to after the USS Nevada. Find photos of Geb then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business, and if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.